All right. Hello, this is Roger Eardley Pryor. I am here for an oral history with Dr. Martin Karplus. We are at Harvard University at his office. Today is May 25th. It is around a little after 1 p.m. Dr. Karplus, thank you again for making time to chat with us today. During our last discussion, we had moved through some aspects of your work, beginning into the protein folding era and moving towards the simulation of biomolecular dynamics. Mm-hmm. Were there some things that you wanted to cover about that time period?
Well, it's a somewhat later time period, but I thought I would go back, and we really didn't discuss protein folding other than the very early work that David Weaver and I did together, where he came over from Tufts, and we sort of discussed, he was a physics professor, we discussed what he might do, and finally agree that I was very interested, partly having seen this film, I don't know whether
the infants
in the film, having this sort of picture of helices coming together, and all of this may already be there, you know, having asked him, did he actually make a model based on this, and he sort of looked at me, and the answer was no. And so after that, sort of I had this idea in my mind, and when David Weaver came along, who knew about fluid dynamics and other things more than I did, we developed this diffusion collision model, which was a very coarse-grained model, but the first model which permitted one to actually calculate some folding rates with reasonable parameters. Now, I've continued to be in contact with David, and what happened is when he retired, it must be now about a little over 10 years ago, because some of his children and grandchildren were at Davis in California, he and his wife decided that they would retire there and he would continue to do research in protein folding, but leave the East Coast. And unfortunately, before actually David could even move there, he had had a stroke. He'd somewhat recovered from the stroke, but then he fell down again, and he passed away before he actually could ever go to Davis. But his wife, Elena, and the Bruker Company, with whom he had collaborated for many years, set up a foundation fund for an annual David Weaver lecture, and in biophysics, I think it's called. I think. And the first lecture was actually 10 years ago, in 2007, and they invited me, because obviously I was very close to David, to give the first lecture. Now, this year was the 10th anniversary, and there was again a David Weaver lecture by Tom Blundell, who is, I guess, Sir Blundell. He's been knighted. He's an outstanding British biophysicist, and he gave the lecture talking about his recent work on drug design. And I was invited to also give a lecture, but this was by the Chancellor of the University of Davis. They have public lectures, about half a dozen a year. And so I had the opportunity to go out there and give this complimentary lecture, which was my marsupial lecture, which may have appeared before in our discussions or not.
I don't believe so. What's the marsupial lecture?
Well, that's in 2007, I was invited to give, I think it's called the Stauffer Lectureships at Stanford. And when you're invited to do that, you're supposed to give a scientific lecture, it's in chemistry or chemistry and biophysics, I don't really remember, and also a public lecture. And so I prepared a public lecture, which is called Motion, the Hallmark of Life, from Marsupials to Molecules. And, it was I didn't realize that when I prepared this lecture that it would really be very useful for me in the future. And I continue to give versions of it. The latest version I gave, I guess it was actually at Davis. Just before, I gave one in Milan as part of, they have a Nobel lectureship at the University of Milan where they were showing my photographs. And it's been updated both in terms of contents and new things being discovered, but it's sort of a vehicle that I must have now given it maybe 15 times. And I never realized that the original investment of time, which was a huge investment trying to put things together that would be scientifically correct, but sort of of interest to a broad public. I mean, the most exciting part of it is where, I'm talking about the importance of myoglobin and oxygen for getting energy. And myoglobin was first crystallized from whales. And there was also this problem with dolphins, actually, not whales, diving, that somebody calculated how much oxygen they had to make the ATP, which they need to make the muscles move, and how long they were able to stay underwater and dive, and they came up that there was a shortage of about 20%. So then they did underwater photography of dolphins, and they noticed that when they swam, they would actually, they mainly are propelled by their tail fins, and they noticed that when they swim, they actually make a stroke, and then they glide and make another stroke, and then they glide again. And so they save enough energy, about 30% actually of what it would require, so they're actually able to do it with the amount of oxygen that they have to make the ATP. And so this gives me an excuse to show some beautiful pictures with lots of splash noise of dolphins. In particular, there are the spinning dolphins, which are these dolphins which sort of go in the air and turn around. They don't do that. They go up in the air and they keep spinning and then fall into the water, and they keep on doing that. And so I show that and with sound effects, and you hear just this loud splashing of the waters. So anyway, so that's this lecture.
The marsupial, and that was something you gave at the inaugural, during the time when this David Weaver lectureship.
Because I have not actually prepared it, but I have not given it in the David Weaver lectureship started in. I gave it 10 years ago, mm-hmm. in 2006, and I actually gave a sort of more general lecture on how proteins work. And so I hadn't actually prepared this public lecture. And when I was invited to give a talk, and it was supposed to be a popular talk at this chancellor's thing, I wondered, did I actually give the marsupial lecture when I was first there? But then I looked up things, and it was clear that I couldn't have, because I only prepared in 2007, which was just after. So I was able to give it there, and it's always well received, and the whole festivities around the Weaver lectures and such it's a very warm activity. Almost all of the people who have lectured have been people that I chose, like Chris Dobson, Greg Petsko, Arup Chakrabarty, Jack Schostak, and so on. There's been one that I didn't choose, and they've all been outstanding. So it's really a lectureship that's done very, very well, and it was very nice to be able to be there on the 10th anniversary. All the families there, the Weavers have three boys, the youngest of which is the age of my son, whom you just Misha, yeah, who you saw here. Mm. And they were very good friends when, you know, the Weavers lived in Medford, and we used to go over there often to their house, and they'd play in the basement and such. So, you know, it's sort of this very warm occasion.
How did you and David Weaver first meet? If he was at Tufts and then came over for his sabbatical to work together with you?
Well, he just asked me. He said, well, you know, I'm tired of doing high energy physics, and I wanted to do something else. I wanted to get in biology, and he noted my name. And so he just asked me, could he come over? And then he did, and as I sort of mentioned just at the beginning, we sort of discussed what might be a problem that was of interest, and that sort of his background in physics was well suited for.
When you chose your problem to work on, was the Leventhal paradox, Psi Leventhal's paradox, something that was on your radar for both of you, or was that something that came up later?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure he had a radar in this area, to be honest, but no, of course it was on my radar, and I don't think we discussed it in there, though we might have. I mean, essentially, one way of solving the Leventhal paradox probably is mentioned there, is that, you know, if you simplify the system, so rather than having one long polypeptide chain where every amino acid can have three or four different orientations, out of which, you know, if you have 100 amino acid chains, you can make, you know, 100, five or whatever it is to the hundreds different configurations, and that to search through them step by step would not work. I mean, that was basically Leventhal, that they're all equally probable. And so one way of is to, in fact, reduce this search that you form helices, which are relatively stable. They may not be completely stable. They may fold and unfold, but still, so that the search problem, say, for myoglobin, which has 150 residues, there are 8 helices in myoglobin. So it's reduced to such space. So it is a way of solving the Leventhal paradox for helical proteins. And we also did some work later on beta sheet proteins with the same sort of model. And as is mentioned in some of the later papers with David, at the time that the model was made, there weren't enough data to actually test the model, and there was only, at least 10 years later or so, that data were around which showed that indeed the model was consistent with the folding of helical proteins. And so that was one approach. And however, we wanted to have a more general approach to protein folding. And sort of as a background, one has to say, although you could do molecular dynamic simulation of a protein in its native conformation or looking from one conformation to another, to do protein folding, you're just assuming even that everything was correct, all your potential function was correct, and just going to the computer, pressing a button, and doing molecular dynamics to fold the protein, it was just out of the question. So one still had to use a simplified model, and that was actually where the idea of lattice models, where basically the protein has 20, well, in the particular lattice model that we use.
This is in the publication from 94 in Nature.
Right.
How does the Nature fold?
Right. Yeah. We use a cubic lattice and a model protein which had 27 residues. And on the cubic lattice, each residue is, you know, well, if it were completely free, it would have, if it's at one lattice site, then it could go to three other, or whatever, depending whether it's on the edge, or otherwise it could go to five others, I guess, of course. And so that's all. And so then for that case, you can't sort of solve it for all conformations either, just like a protein. However, what you can do is to do simulations where basically you say that the native state, which is some configuration of the 27 beads in this cube, is low energy, and that there is sort of an energy gradient as the protein folds up from an extended configuration to the native one. But there are many, many pathways of doing this. And so it does, although it's a simplified model, it still has the Leventhal paradox that if it did it by its search of all the conformations to find the right one, it would never do it in, these are actually Monte Carlo rather than molecular simulations, but again, it would take forever in terms of the computer time that was available. Nevertheless, what we found was that if the native state was a relatively stable minimum, then we took, I think, 200 possible sequences and watched them and did Monte Carlo simulations of a reasonable number of steps. You know, it didn't take a huge amount of time. And we found that out of these 200, 30 or so actually folded to the native state. So they clearly couldn't have done it by doing a complete search of their reduced space, but still an infinite space in terms of the length of the Monte Carlo simulation to do. And then we analyzed what happened, and we saw that basically the folding process was sort of stepwise. That if we take an extended chain, first of all, it would collapse, and it was sort of a random globule, as it's called. These collapsed states with no real structure are called random globules. And then within this collapsed globule, the available states are much, much smaller. And so it only had to search through those, which basically permitted it. It was doing a random search within that slightly energy biased, but that's what permitted it to find the native state. So, you know, this paper with the title How Protein Folds was published in Nature, and probably would be that, you know, were quite a few papers on protein folding. I mean, none from this point of view, but much more with phenomenological models that people made, which weren't any good for doing calculations on them, but were conceptual models that had been in the literature for quite a few years. And so my guess is that, except for serendipity, a historical accident, this paper would have been just one more in this series of papers. However, Baldwin, who was one of the people working in protein folding, a professor at Stanford, Buzz Baldwin, wrote a News and Views article in Nature saying, you know, that this was really something terrific and that finally we had sort of solved the Leventhal paradox. And, you know, as I write somewhere, my impression is that many people don't read the papers in Nature, they just read the News and Views. And so this really became widely known and widely talked about. There was also a personal result of this, is that Peter Wolinus, who's been working protein folding for years and whom we cited liberally about his work, Bringelson Wolinus, which is a famous paper on protein folding. There are several citations to him. Notice that Baldwin didn't cite him at all.
Didn't cite who?
Peter Wolinus. Baldwin, in this News and Views article, which we had nothing to do with, I mean, we were very pleasantly surprised that it appeared, didn't cite Wolinus. that we had perfectly well sighted. So he got furious. And so then there is sort of started, well, I don't know how much of this you actually want to put in, we'll see. I mean, as I say, he was furious about this. He wrote nasty letters to us.
To you and your group directly.
It's fair to say that, well, there were three people involved. Eugene and I was sort of the lead people, and Andre Sali was the one who did all. I mean, in those days you didn't say what each person did, nowadays you do, but did actually do all the simulations and such. And so it was furious at Eugene and me. And, you know, I tried to say, you know, we didn't write this article, and I suppose in retrospect, I think I discussed this somewhere or other, I probably should have realized that Baldwin not mentioning Peter, who regarded himself, and rightly so, as being one of the pioneers in discussing protein folding in more statistical, mechanical, general terms, rather than sort of making, I mean, I always like to have something concrete that I'm looking at and try to understand and learn from it. He is much more a general statistical mechanician. And if I had been more insightful, I would have written something immediately to say, look, we did this work, but, you know, as I wrote in something else, you know, like Venus on the half shell, unlike Venus on the half shell, you know, protein, any sort of science that doesn't develop by itself spontaneously, there are many other people who work. But I didn't do that. And so then Peter got one of his people to write some sort of an attack article, and I wrote then. You know, an article is basically trying to say, look, we know all this, but no, it's not that we did anything wrong. And anyway, but
what was the article that Peter wrote? Do you remember?
Well, he didn't. It's probably in here. It's by somebody named Chan. Mm. I mean, he didn't actually write it. For some reason, he didn't want to be the one who wrote it. I don't. Well, it's probably mentioned yet. I think the guy's name was Chan, and then he wrote an article, and you know, saying how horrible we were, and we basically, I just iterated what I said, that we couldn't be blamed for. Or we shouldn't be blamed. We could evidently, but we shouldn't be blamed for the fact that Baldwin didn't cite us. And Baldwin, well, first he asked Baldwin, that's true, first Peter asked Baldwin to sort of retract in some sense, to say, look, this is not the way it happened. But Baldwin said, no, it's, he didn't, he just said he didn't want to do it. I mean, he didn't justify himself. So this sort of has, you know, went on, and I think Peter still hasn't forgiven me. And I'm sure he feels he should have had one of the Nobel Prizes, so it had really nothing but both protein folding. But anyway, it's sort of too bad. He's a very good scientist, but he's had fallouts with other people as well, that he's where he worked with them, together with them, and then the question of credit and such. I won't go into more detail about that. The importance was, to a certain extent, that I wrote this other paper called The Lilienthal Paradox, Yesterday and Today.
The one from 1997?
From, is that when it is? Yeah, probably.
And that was originally a talk you gave abroad,
correct? That's
right, correct?
Abroad. There was a meeting of folding and design, and at least some of the talks, appeared in the Folding and Design, which had its, which was an independent journal for a certain amount of time, I think edited by Alan Furst, and then it was taken over by Structure, and so, but no, this, you're right, this was basically based on a talk, and what I basically say here is that two types of things, I think, which are of interest. One sort of refers to the change in the view of the Leventhal paradox and how difficult it is for proteins to fold, echoed what happened a little bit with molecular dynamics of proteins. And it was, 20 years ago or so before this was written, this was 97, so that was 77 when the first molecular dynamics simulations came out. There was a meeting in England where D.C. Phillips, who was the crystallographer who did the first enzyme structure, crystal structure, he wrote the period 96 to 75 may be described as the decade of the rigid macromolecule. Brass models of DNA and a variety of proteins dominated the scene and much of the thinking. And then in the intermediate period, since the molecular dynamics simulations, everybody realized that they should have anyway, that proteins, are not brass models, but the atoms are connected by relatively weak springs, so at room temperature, every one of them must have 3 kT of energy, more or less, and so they must be vibrating. Nevertheless, people saw a beautiful X-ray structure, says that's the protein structure, and didn't consider the motions, and it really took another, many years for people to be aware that proteins were fluctuating systems, and so that the paradigm changed from proteins being rigid systems to proteins being fluctuating systems. And so my feeling, as expressed here, was that people had always focused on the Leventhal paradox and asked, how can the protein fold? Now, after some of these simulations were published, the question arose, why do proteins fold so slowly? So essentially that the conceptual idea changed, and basically in a sort of as I say here, it's not a great exaggeration to say that the pessimistic view of yesterday, it is impossible for proteins to find the native state, even if they do so readily in solution, has been replaced by the optimistic viewpoint of today. It's obvious that proteins should be able to fold rapidly to the native state. And so what I say here, which is of sort of more general interest, is that science has paradigms, and it even without very clear reasons, it moves from one paradigm to another, and that's how progress takes place very often.
You've mentioned elsewhere this really neat quote by Richard Feynman, that everything in the molecular world is and in biology in particular, can be explained by the jiggling and wiggling of atoms.
Right, right.
If Feynman had that view in the early 60s,
right,
and it took all the way through after the 1977 BPTI calculation to really show that to be done, why do you think it took so long between this conceptual point up to, was it the ability to calculate these on computers? Is that part of the story?
Well, I think certainly, paradigms. He was a physicist. He wrote this wonderful three-volume. Well, he didn't write it. He gave the lectures, and his students wrote it. Three-volume lectures on physics, which talk about all kinds of things. Mm. And he has a little section on biology where this quote appears, and it had sort of disappeared actually, until I found it, and now almost every paper on molecular dynamics has this quote. I also found, this also in the Marsupial lecture, that actually Titus Lucretius, a Greek, well, he was a Roman poet, who wrote one poem that we know about called The Nature of Things. And he describes the motions of atoms, and you could imagine that, it says the motions of atoms, and as they move around, I'd have to look it up exactly to have it, you know, until finally they form everything we know today. I mean, it's amazing, you know, it was, and actually the Greeks knew a lot about atoms. Democritus described solids and liquids, that solids, you know, have very tightly bonded atoms, and liquids have very weakly bonded atoms, so they can move relative to each other without a huge amount of data. And then this whole atomic model, I won't call it a theory, of structure disappeared for 2,000 years until Dalton came up with the atomic theory. And I mean, he didn't, I'm sure he didn't know anything about Lucretius, and he did, you know, very careful measurements, including from Avogadro's number and all this. But it just, for 2,000 years, this idea was just lost, and, which is also sort of interesting.
I'm fascinated to learn where your realization of some of those ancient, deeper connections to these Hellenistic worldviews of atomic structure came from. Was that part of the Marsupial research, the research to do that lecture on the motions?
No, that particular part came, again, by accident. There's a scholar here named Greenblatt who's written a book, it's called The Stream, and it talks about the development of atomic theory and various other things. I mean, he's actually a Shakespeare scholar in addition, but he's also has written a lot about ancient Greeks and what they knew, and he's at Harvard. And probably, I'm just making this up, the Harvard Gazette maybe had an interview with him or something like that. And I saw this, and I thought, it's interesting. And then I got in contact with him, and this quote, in quotes, that I give is his sort of maybe free translation from the Roman thing. But it's really amazing to see. And he's a very interesting fellow, but it was really, as I say, I don't remember the exact, but it was something like that I came across it. I'm not a Greek scholar and such, but I do sort of remember things. I often don't remember all of the details, but I do sort of capture, I think that's one of the abilities that I have, the essence of something. And then I sort of, it comes back to me, and I can look it up, and then I look, you know, it's basically how I looked it up, and then decided, this would be great to have in the Marsupial talk, I mean, yeah, to give sort of a general culture to this.
I'm also interested to go back to the How Does a Protein Fold publication in Nature that creates this lattice, and in order to try to calculate the energy within that space and the movement in that space, where did that idea come from, to create this sort of bounded area that you could quantify?
Well, it's again, to a certain extent, an older idea. I'm not sure who is the original person. It was probably Abbe and Go. And I will refer to it here. It's probably Abbe and Go, Japanese biophysicist, who was looked at two-dimensional lattices. Yeah, 1981. It's Go and Abbe, 1981, made a pioneering study in this area, and they did it in two dimensions. And basically had some of the same ideas as we had, but it wasn't, I mean, they couldn't do all these, you know, really show that it worked sort of in a general sense, in a system that had the Leventhal paradox, that the system was large enough to have that, to do what we did, but the original idea, you know, was theirs, and I'm sure I was aware of it. I knew Go quite well. I'm not quite sure whether he's still alive. Noburo Go. And he also, at one time I went to Japan when he organized the conference. He was really a wonderful individual, and also, so I would say if anybody should receive credit for it, the original sort of idea was Go. And he refers to the harmony principle of protein folding, that there are lots of weak interactions between the different atoms or amino acids, and that the stabilizing interactions that you get from them lead to the native state. It's what he called the harmony principle. And so, as I say here, the work of Go and Abe and Bringelson and Wolmanis contain many insights that are important for the present-day view of protein folding. However, they appear to have had rather little impact on experimentalists. As sometimes happens, I was going to say that, but it's a bit here better than I could. As sometimes happens in science, papers are published before the time has come. And they weren't sort of very neat and clear-cut as to what happened. And also people weren't interested really in folding. It's only, as more and more protein structures were determined, and of course nowadays protein folding with gene sequences and everything else, because you have lots of gene sequences of proteins, and it would be lovely to be really able to take all these sequences and determine the structure of the protein on a computer, but we aren't there yet. And so maybe this is an excuse to go on to something more recent, if I can find it. This is a paper with Amadeo Kaflisch and I thought I pulled it out, so I can pull out another copy if you want to stop it for a second.
Sure. All right, you found the paper you're referencing.
I'm not sure that it was in there. May not have been.
This is the one titled "One-Dimensional Barrier Preserving Free Energy Projections of B-sheet Mini Protein."
Beta sheet mini protein.
New insights into the folding process from 2008 in JFISCAN.
Now, before going to that, mentioning doing things before the idea has come. Long ago, I can look it up. You hold it up one other second.
We'll just let it run. It's okay. There's plenty of space on it.
Okay. Mukherjee and I have published sort of a simple quantum mechanical calculation of hydrogen fluoride in 1963, long called constrained molecular wave functions. Paper 31.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The hydrogen fluoride molecule. And what we did there, it was because you couldn't do very accurate quantum mechanical calculations the way you can nowadays on big computers with lots of basis sets and all that. It was a minimal basis set. And one of the I've always been interested, and this goes back to what happened in Oxford when I was a postdoc, what I wanted to do was theoretical chemistry that was of interest to chemistry rather than just the rest of the theoretical chemists. And so one of the molecular quantities that one can measure experimentally and trying to calculate is the dipole moment of a molecule. It's sort of a very crucial part of it. And so we did a calculation on the hydrogen fluoride ion, which has a large dipole moment, and we realized that the dipole moment didn't come out correct. So we thought, well, clearly the wave function wasn't correct, but we had the idea, well, if we constrain the dipole moment to be the correct value, then the wave function would be a better approximation than just doing without. And so we did that. And nobody was interested in the paper, as far as I can tell. But in the last few years, doing much, you know, larger scale calculations, people have suddenly discovered this idea that doing calculations and constraining the wave function with certain approaches to do this constraint, which are rather sophisticated, which we did there, is really a very useful thing to do. Even, for example, if you want to have two, also could be diatomic, and you really want to have the wave function artificially, well, it's an ion and the neutral atom would be the sort of chemical description, and you want all the extra electron to stay on the ion, then you constrain the wave function so that the extra electron is confined to this ion. And basically, they used the methods that we developed in 1963, and one or two of the people, one is an MIT, name escaped me, I'll actually refer to our paper, and some other people, I wrote, well, look, you know, it's nice. But I think, as I say, the essential point was, yes, it was clever what we did, but so what? I mean, it didn't advance science.
At the time.
Nobody actually used our paper and said, ha, that's a good thing to do. Let's do it now that we can do things so much better. I mean, it just had no effect. You know, you drop a pebble in water, yeah. It disappears, unless a fish eats. And so I think, you know, that's one of the lessons that one learns. You can say to myself, yeah, I was really clever. I had this idea, it's now 50 years ago or something like that. But as far as science is concerned, it was not a useful idea. Mm.
Until later. So I'm kind of interested in that, your ideas on that. So the theoretical idea you came up with, why do you think it came into greater use later? And again, I'm wondering if there's a technological component to that.
Well, it certainly is that you could do much better calculations, but my point is the idea per se none of the people who were trying to do this localizing the charge distribution said, this is the way we should do it, and it was as a result of this. They reinvented, just as one says, reinvented the wheel, or Dalton reinvented Dalton's the atomic theory. So in the same way, Titus Lucretius, or it didn't, and I think that's an important thing to remember. And there are a number of other things that I've done that way, and you know, and when I see somebody's doing it, I might write in and say, look, but I realize that. So somehow, you know, if you have an idea before its time has come, you know, nothing will happen. That was, of course, a little bit in molecular dynamics, where it took a while before people were really willing to accept it.
The idea of moving.
I mentioned this, but I mentioned Phillips and one of the first lectures I gave on molecular dynamics and such was there. Did I talk about this?
No, please do.
In Oxford. And there was mainly crystallographers in the audience.
When was this?
Must have been shortly after 77, maybe in the early 80s. And I said, in BPDI, there are four tyrosine atoms. I still have a model of BPDI up there. And these tyrosine amino acids, and they, and what we find is that on a very fast time scale, they flip. And crystallographers say, you know, tyrosines are the best determined because those big flat things, they couldn't be flipping. And they didn't realize that, sure, I mean, 99% of the time they're like this, then all of a sudden they flip. But it's exactly the same structure. So the fact that they actually do flip was just beyond that, and they didn't believe it in a certain sense.
How did they register that during your talk?
Well, some said, well, first that they couldn't be wrong, and I couldn't really convince them that they didn't understand what was going on, that, you know, they do average structures in X-ray crystallography, and sure, as far as they're concerned, if you take a time average, or average a lot of the crystals, that they're in one way or the other way, but the two ways are equivalent. Now, if they had different, like if it were a substituted tyrosine so that you could see that it had an OH out here and then it flipped over, the OH was here, then you would say that's a small energy difference, there's disorder in the crystal, and that, if they do high resolution, they could see. But this is something they can't tell the difference between the two of them, and, you know, and crystallographers didn't want to believe that. And again, it took quite a while for them to believe it, but there, I think, you know, the simulations and such were timely and had a lot of effect on their thinking. And I remember there's a paper by of Huber, who was a crystallographer and won a Nobel Prize. I don't know exactly when, but I was just very amused when he sort of emphasized that in a certain crystal structure, you couldn't see part of the molecule. And he said, you know, that shows motion of the molecule. To say now that, you know, if they have a lousy crystal structure, you can get something out of it. And it's probably true. I don't think it showed motion. Again, it showed that there was disorder, and there's a difference between disorder that each, to get a good crystal structure, every molecule in the crystal should be pretty much the same. So anyway, so go on. Now let me finish
articles. Yes.
Well, it's sort of the next stage in studying protein folding. For a long time, it wasn't possible to simulate folding sort of just by molecular dynamics. However, by using relatively simple systems, and this was a double beta hairpin, and using implicit solvent. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, most of the time, if you're simulating a protein and you want to get a reliable simulation, you simulate it. I mean, you're in the cell, it's actually in a very complicated medium, but as a first approximation to that, you put it in water, and maybe in water with ions. And then it turns out that 99% of the simulation time is spent simulating water. So you could do it 100 times faster if you didn't actually have to simulate the water. And for that, people, many different groups. I mean, one, Themis Lazaridis, who worked with me, developed a very simple implicit solvent model, which represents the solvent in a very simplified way as sort of an effective potential. Charlie Brooks has developed more sophisticated ones, but in any case, these are very important. And Amadeo Kaflisch, who is a former postdoctoral student who is now in Zurich on the faculty of the University of Zurich and has done really some outstanding work. He started doing folding simulations of this double beta hairpin, and in particular an implicit solvent, and so that you could look, if you study it at the temperature where the denatured state and the native state are stable, and you do molecular dynamic simulations that take only a reasonable amount of time, reasonable meaning that you can do it with the computers that are available, you can watch hundreds of folding, unfolding transitions. And so this sort of became a model system where people tried different approaches to understand, you know, the protein folding process, and there probably have been at least 100 and many more papers written by other people, usually collaborating with him on studying this system. And so it's obviously a model that's more realistic than the lattice model. And so it's been, I think, very important. Mm-hmm. And Sergei Krustov, who was one of the postdoc with me, and I'm still working with him on other problems, how the brain works, but that's something else that maybe we'll get to. We did a paper which studied the protein folding there. And it turns out that it's much more complicated. There are many pathways, but you can develop networks. Simplified networks and sort of different metastable states which go flow into each other. And what Sergei developed was a method of representing this whole complex behavior in one dimension, essentially, to reduce it that way without losing information. And so this beta hairpin, is sort of, in a way, other people were doing other things, was an important next step in going to more realistic models. And it's now only recently, I think in 2010 actually, that David Shaw and his co-workers with the special purpose computer, the Anton, that they developed, has been able to take some small proteins that had maybe up to 40 or 50 amino acids, or even less, 30 amino acids or so, and actually observe in a realistic description with full solvent and everything, many unfolding simulations. And again, now people are sort of shifting, if you like, from this being the paradigm system to some of these small proteins that the Shaw group has studied and trying to analyze. I mean, he has, just as Amadeo Kaflisch gave away the coordinates as a function of time of the folding and unfolding, so the Shaw group has made all of these coordinates available, and so many people are using them, sort of mining them for information with different models of protein folding, including Sergei independently, you know, also has tried to interpret what they find, and has found that it disagrees somewhat with the original Shaw interpretation. But anyway, so that gives a little bit the history up to present day of protein folding, the sort of the dynamics of protein folding. I mean, there's sort of another aspect. I mean, there are really two protein folding problems, one always says. One is, given a sequence, what's the structure of the protein, the native structure, and the other is how it gets there. Now, if you could reliably fold a protein by molecular dynamics, you would solve the other problem because you take the sequence, you put it on a computer, and get the structure. But that's not true yet for really. And so a number of people, including David Baker, has developed predictive methods for taking a sequence, what the structure will be, or conversely saying, what he's more famous for is saying, I want an amino acid sequence that will fold up in a certain way to predict what it may not be the only sequence, but a sequence that reliably folds up to this. It's called the Rosetta program, and that's very important.
And is there an idea to have that translational somehow, to be able to create amino structures to one's will and then use them in a system?
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly beginning. I mean, that type. I mean, you want to have a certain function and enzyme function or something. And in one case, people have taken sort of known structures and tried to predict how they have to modify the amino acid sequence, so an enzyme that hydrolyzes something else would synthesize something. Or it's also do it by de novo folds that do that. I mean, that's coming. It's sort of a little bit in the future, but I mean, the ideas are there to do this sort of in a production way so that drug companies would use it. It's not here yet, really, but it's certainly coming.
In the steps that move through these advances over time, it seems that increasingly more complex systems are able to be modeled. And I'm wondering about, at these early phases, these sort of entry points where many times in your career you've been on this sort of cutting edge of where people are moving, sometimes even ahead of where people are moving. And both with the beta structure, the hairpin beta, and other things, stripping out aspects that you know exist in the system to a minimum point where the model still seems to work seems to be a common approach. Is that something that is a conscious thing, or does that seem to be how these advances happen? Perhaps, for example, stripping out the water in a simulation to create this sort of more simplified model.
Well, I mean, I think there are two aspects to this. One is sort of the practical aspect, that unless you can do that, unless you can say, well, you know, water is certainly important, but we're not primarily interested in that, so let's represent it in the simplest reasonable way. So, and that's what made it possible to do these multiple simulations here. It's one part. The other part is understanding what are the essential elements. Of course, that's obviously, I mean, you wouldn't be able to use a simplified water model if you didn't realize that it had the properties that you needed. And so this gives you a deeper understanding of what's essential and what's sort of peripheral in some sense. And that's certainly an element, I think, in a lot of things I've done.
Also, I'm interested in when talking about the earlier work from 63 with the wave function and confining and having these realizations by controlling one aspect of the process to then highlight some knowns or some of the essential components of the other parts of the process. So I guess is that something as well, that this thought process to what would happen if we confine or limit this part of the system's movement or process to then learn what's important about it? Is that also a method that you...
No, I think that's certainly an element of... I mean, it's one way of trying to, to manipulate the system in a controlled fashion to find out how it works. I mean, that's certainly... it's like taking apart a car engine or something like that. You basically want to find out what parts, if you want a racing car, what parts you can get rid of to get the minimum weight and the most efficient.
Yeah.
So I think that's I mean, I don't think that that's anything peculiar to me in any way. I mean, I think it's sort of a general way that many people do science. I mean, what's a special element about me is that I like to work on something that I haven't worked on before. And I strongly believe that you're most likely to have original ideas if you're not encumbered by what everybody else has said and thinks about it. Obviously, you have to sort of understand what's going on, but if it's something new for you, that you can do things, and there's the father of Lionel Salem was a famous, who was a colleague that I worked with in France, and his father was a banker when he was young, and earned enough money so he could do what he wanted, and he decided to do mathematics. Now people say, you know, you can't do mathematics when you're over 20 or something. I mean, that you have to be really very young. Well, he was 40, but he never thought about mathematical problems. And to him, it was something new. His brain was sort of a tabula rasa, or whatever, as far as this was concerned. And he made a number of important contributions. So, I mean, I think he's one of the examples that I always cite for my own travels, where I try to look at something new. After 5 years, I want to do something else. Mm. And also after 5 years, I moved from one university to another until I got stuck here. Then I went to France. But I finally did come back here and then sort of divide my time between France and here, and found that very useful.
Yeah, new environments.
I don't know whether you want to go on to some of the
I do one other question related to some of this, and that has to do with your trajectory over time. Moved from doing these simulations that were mostly theoretical and working out some sort of basic calculations on a computer, but not with a ton of visualization. And as computer programming moved forward through the 80s, through the 90s, till today, so much more of this work is done on computers, being able to control parts of the system, move things away to see what would happen. And this visualization aspect becomes increasingly more available. So I'm wondering, what was your experience with that? Are there things certainly to be gained with that? But because you've seen these advances and you helped make them possible, are there things that are lost during that?
Well, I still think that having a three-dimensional model like that, you can turn it around. Well, I mean, you can do all that on the computer, but it just is not the same. And I was...
In what way?
Well, to me, you know, having grown up with these puppet beads models, which kids used, and John Mack made a living for a while of making these very simplified but accurate models. So it's not quite the same. On the other hand, I may have told you this story, that I didn't sort of believe very much in graphics when we started doing these calculations. I mean, we had to sort of draw things a little bit to see. But there was this one case where we took a protein structure and then we folded it up in some way to change the structure, and then we put it on the computer and we minimized the energy, we did dynamics, we did everything, and the energy stayed very, very high. So there was clearly something wrong, and in those days we sort of looked at the coordinates and everything, and we really couldn't figure out what was wrong. And then we did have the VACs and a very crude graphic system that was developed by Evans and Sutherland here, which we actually used for making the first film of a chemical reaction, H plus H2, when it was still there was a ray graphics, much better than the pixel graphics that you have nowadays. It was really beautiful, but sort of gone, except for television, I guess, where it's sort of coming back, essentially. But anyway, so we did look at pictures of it, and what we saw had happened is that as we had changed the conformation, we had put one amino acid through the center of another one. And, you know, there was no way of getting it out of there. But it was also, you know, we'd spent days trying to figure out that, you know, the coordinates didn't look so bad. But as soon as you saw that, you realized, ha, you know, we'd by, you know, just sort of folding it up manually, more or less. I mean, we didn't worry about something like that, and we couldn't find it until we saw it on the graphic system. So that convinced me that it's of some use. Nowadays, I guess probably the most popular program is one that is continuing to be developed by Klaus Schulten, who was a student here, partly with me, and I think partly with Dudley Hirschbach, but really what he's moved completely into the biophysical area, and he's developed probably the VMD, which is the most widely used program. Everybody uses it, and it's
for visualizing.
For visualizing, it's really very good, and you can play with it in many ways. And I think it certainly is very important. And now, you know, we do look at things all the time, and we've sort of learned that yes, seeing is really very helpful in understanding what's going on.
Mm. Klaus Schulten's work with NAMD, his simulating program, and then VMD, mm-hmm. the visualizing program. Did you have any connection with his development of those? Did he approach you in any way, or is there any kind of collaboration you had done since he was a grad student in the 70s? Or has he kind of taken his own path?
Well, there's often been talk about collaborating, but it never happened. I mean, at one point, he thought it would be good to sort of essentially combine the work of both groups.
CHARM group?
The CHARM group and the NAMD group and everything. And I think at that time he was probably having trouble getting funding and such. And he thought that having it combined and with me, that there was a greater likelihood that it would continue to exist. It's turned out that he's been very effective in getting funding, and you know, he has a big group, part of which has permanent people that are essentially involved in this, both NMD and VMD. Phillips, I think, is the guy's name. But you know, we had joint meetings and everything, but it never went anywhere.
Mm.
We also...
Why is that? It seems like the...
Well, I mean, they don't have I mean, I think he has no reason to. I don't think we would provide anything that would help him. I mean, I think he's very good, and he has been able to get all the funding because, you know, his programs are so widely used. And, like, in calculations that we do nowadays, if we're just doing pure molecular dynamics, we will set up the problem with CHARM. I mean, one of the things that has happened and that we actually did work together on was to make sure that in NAMD they had really an accurate representation of the force field in CHARM, so that if we calculated something with NAMD rather than with CHARM, that it would be consistent with it. And I think that's been an important interaction, and we've done this with AMBER with other programs as well. But so what I started to say is sometimes if we're just doing sort of pure molecular dynamics, we'll set up the problem with CHARM, do the calculation with NAMD, which is faster than particularly if you can use a large number of processors. I mean, it scales better to larger number of processors than CHARM does. And then, again, analyze the output with CHARM. So we use it, and I think many other people do some similar things. Mm-hmm. But so it is a community service. I think it's very good that he continues to give its support. And he has also done sort of work on his scientific work on his own, which I would say, well, much of it is very good, but it's a little bit sort of characterized of being able to doing bigger systems, because that's what he's able to do, and he has the time to do it. Then has gotten some working on viruses and such, capsids, and But I mean, the short answer is we don't really collaborate on almost anything, though. Yeah.
I'm interested in CHARM as well, since you're bringing it up as this computer program that evolved from Bruce Gallen's work and his, some of his early programming, and then officially was published and announced as a thing in the early 80s,
right.
and has since continued to be developed mm-hmm. over time. That program in particular is, you need to have a license to use it, so it's commercialized.
Well, I mean, the answer is yes, but there are two aspects. I mean, it's basically, well, the CHARM program, you know, is licensed by Harvard to nonprofit organizations. In addition, it's sold through a company which is now called, which has gone through many incarnations, but now it's called Biovia, which was recently bought a year or so ago by the Salt Systems. That's a whole other story, but I'm not. And the reason we charged originally was A, to cover the costs of some of the what it was necessary to do to license things. We wanted to make sure that, partly because it was also sold commercially, that the people who got it, if they were honest, you know, were really at academic institutions. And I think that's basically been true, that most companies, it's just not worth their while, and it's such a small amount of their budget. But also, originally we did this, you know, when making tapes and everything was a certain amount of effort to discourage people from just saying we want it. And you know, they had to sort of think, and it turned out at first it was $200, then it was $400, which had this sort of effect that they thought twice, and if they didn't really need it, they didn't try to get it. Now it's $600, and probably could be somewhat higher, but we don't really know. So it was really, that was the rationale, because it was a lot of work, and and that's sort of mainly true at Harvard in contrast to other places. You don't really have permanent people, you know, who work in your labs and staff scientists or something. It's just not the way this Harvard is set up. It's changing a little bit. But anyway, so that's how the fact that the license arose and the charge arose.
Yeah. So essentially to recoup the cost of updating it and also replicating it for people that wanted it.
But, yeah, making sure that they did want it. Now, of course, now we have a system. I mean, we still charge for the full version, but it's now mainly automatic. The people can just press a button, but they still have to pay one way or another. And, it's much more automated.
Was this your first experience with a commercialized scientific work?
Yeah.
What was the impetus at the time, then, and not earlier?
Commercializing
other earlier work?
Well, I never thought of it. And actually, the way it happened is that David Wales and somebody else, Andy Ferrara, who were neighbors, came to me and said, look, we have this idea. We think it would make a commercial entity. And I thought for a while about it. And then I thought, well, the original idea was, the concept was the following. I mean, one important thing was that for academic institutions, we had complete control. And the second was that the concept was that, okay, you know, which was at that time essentially people at Harvard, now it's people from all over the world. There are about 40 development groups.
On CHARM,
mm-hmm. Yeah, mainly former students or former students of students, children, grandchildren, whatever. And the idea was that, okay, we put these tools together, but we realized it wasn't the commercial program, you know, that you would expect for commercial usage, that they would be cleaner and everything. And they were supposed to do that. They never did. And we also did. Actually, I didn't mention the fact that it slipped my mind that we, Robert Hubbard, Rob, can't think of his first name at the moment. Whatever, Hubbard came to visited Harvard, and Rod Hubbard, and said, look, you have this molecular dynamics program, wouldn't it be nice to have the graphics program to go with it?
Where did he come from?
He from York. He came actually from the crystallographic group in York that involved in some of the early people who worked on insulin. Hmm. And he had seen some of our papers. He thought, you know, he was very interested in graphics, and so he came over and developed a graphics program, which was called Hydra, because it had seven heads or something. And it was really a lot of fun. I mean, he's very clever in graphics development, and we would say, well, we would like to be able to do this one day, and then he would work overnight, and the next day he'd show it to us, and so we would sort of work together to develop this program. And that was actually then the company, which was called Polygen, used that as their original graphics program. And they don't use it anymore, they use other programs, but that was actually, one of the very earliest graphics programs that was designed to go with molecular dynamics simulations, that you could sort of follow them in real computer time or whatever and look at them.
How did he? So did he join your CHARM, your group, or part of CHARM? How did he pay for his time? Was that something he just did on his own? Polygen paid for?
I think he had. The answers I don't really remember. I think he still had his position in New York, I mean, where they are sort of more, they have more, Europe in general, they have many more permanent people. In fact, almost everybody is permanent as soon as they start, and firing them can be very difficult. And so I think he had this position in New York. I don't think I paid in anything. I may have paid sort of living expenses here or something like that. But he came and said, look, I want to do this. And as I say, it was a heady time, as one says, where, you know, we really, just the way I described. I mean,
and that was in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
Shortly after the CHARM had been commercialized,
right,
as well.
Yeah.
There seems to be this shift in the early 1980s, and this is moving, getting some of your experience as a result of some of these policy changes that happen. The Bayh-Dole Act that allows for universities to commercialize their work, even if it comes from funding, NSF funding or NIH funding.
Never knew about that.
Yeah, and so
I know you mentioned this in the write-up. Before that, when was that?
That law was passed around 1980. Mm. So along with the Reagan Revolution comes this kind of new idea about commercializing science.
I never knew about any of that.
So it just happened at that time.
Yeah,
as a result.
Think about it. Maybe Wales and such knew about that, and that's why they came here. And we did, you know, we had Joyce Brinton, and we had a office of something or other which was concerned, and certainly
Harvard concerned about the commercialization.
That took care of any contracts that we might have with industry. Mm-hmm. I know that for a while was working on AIDS inhibitors and such, and understanding AIDS with a company, and they made sure that that we didn't violate any Harvard rules in mm-hmm. terms of that things had to be publishable and things like that within a certain time. And well, having these rules and this office was great, because you know, it wasn't I who was being nasty, it was Harvard who was being nasty, and I could say, well, you know, I can't do this, so you can't keep it secret. And actually, Marcy probably remembers this better than I do. We had something, we had developed an inhibitor for something that was useful, and involved Merck in some way, mm-hmm. and Merck did not want to make it public that it existed. I can't remember the whole story, but
remember the time frame? 90s or 2000s?
I could probably look it up, but I don't remember exactly. But what happened was that basically I told them at the time, would they be happy if the New York Times published an article saying that they were keeping this from being available or something like that. And then they said fine.
It allowed you to publish in scientific journals.
Yeah.
So that's actually an interesting thing. It sounds to me like there was some work you did consulting.
Yeah.
When did that begin? Because chemists especially have done consulting work for a long time.
Yeah, organic chemists make their living, I think, about consulting. And
absolutely.
Their Harvard salaries sort of...
And I remember you had done work that wasn't quite consulting, but... Bell Labs wanted you to become more full-time with their consulting.
Yeah.
And you said, no, I want to do my work for me. And that was in the 50s.
Right, that was with Shulman and a number of when Bell Labs were the sites. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I also consulted for a number of other companies. I'm still a consultant for the present incarnation of Polygen, which is Veovia. We just had a huge meeting on Monday where there were about 1,000 people or something, where I gave a lecture in connection with the meeting. And off and on I consulted. I mean, it was never, again, I always had this feeling I was happy to do the consulting, but I always felt that my lifestyle should be that, you know, if it disappeared, it wouldn't make any difference. I mean, probably the most where I earned the most money was in connection with Vertex, the founding of Vertex. Mm-hmm. Vertex. It's a drug company founded by Josh Boger, who was a student of Jeremy Knowles at Harvard, and I and a number of other people, Stuart Schreiber, were on the Science Advisory Board. And so we received stock and other. And then there was another company, Enanta, which all of a sudden it turned out was a success, and I'd almost thrown away my stock, but they had records of it, and so. But anyway, it was Vertex was the first where it was a much more of a relationship. I mean, that we were about five Harvard people were on the Science Advisory Board, and it turned out to be quite a successful. It still exists, which in itself is successful, and I think it's making money for a long time. It was just spending more money, but people had faith in it. But anyway.
What kind of work do they do, and what work did you do with them?
It's again design work on diabetes, cystic fibrosis, and different diseases essentially, and they've been successful in some of them, have some things in the clinic, but anyway, so, and that, you know, we've received stock, but kept the stock until it went from, well, what I paid for it was nothing at the height. It was in the $100 or per share, and now it's gone down a little bit. And what I've done is always sold a little bit when it was high up, or when we needed it, but the saying is, you know, it didn't affect our overall lifestyle. On the other hand, we had money to buy the apartment in Strasbourg, for example, that we lived in for many years, and so in that sense it was very useful.
When did some of these consulting opportunities arise? Was this also time frame wise? I'm wondering.
Well, in the 90s or so, yeah.
Mostly a lot in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, that's a particular, well, I have to, again, I'm very bad with dates. I mean, yeah, I'd certainly look it up. And Stuart and I, well, I mean, one of the things that happened is that Vertex was very interested in FKBP and cyclosporin and some of these compounds, and they were interested in the structure of that, and Stuart and I, with a postdoc work, determined the structure, and Josh Boga was when we said we were perfectly happy to give him the structure, but he wanted to have determined the structure first. He was, anyway, and so we basically were fired from the Science Advisory Board, and so we didn't get, we only got half of the shares we would have gotten, because it took years to vest them. And it's all written up in a book called The Billion Dollar Molecule.
Oh.
Have you ever heard of that?
No.
For a while it was a bestseller, I think. And this whole story about Vertex and
fascinating. How are you doing? Do you need to take a break, or are you doing okay?
I'm doing fine. If you want to take a break,
no, I'm great.
Okay. We had, maybe I'll have a little bit.
Yeah. We had mentioned the early '90s, and a couple of the papers that you were interested in talking about involve computer simulation that seems to be a combination of the quantum and the molecular mechanics.
Nice.
One of them is a JCOMP Chem article from 1990 that you did with Dr. M.J. Field, P.A. Bash, and yourself.
Right.
It was titled Combined Quantum Mechanical and Molecular Mechanical Potential for Molecular Dynamic Simulation.
And
what is some of that work that you were doing with Bash and Field and others?
Well, of course, this goes a little bit to mentioning the Nobel Prize, mm-hmm. because the Nobel Prize was in fact given for some, I can't even remember exactly what the title is, multi-scale simulation method or something like that.
They said something like that. I think they have multi-scale models for chemical complex systems.
Right. Yeah, right. Multi-scale models for complex systems, chemical systems.
But I've heard in our conversations, I've heard you mention that you think the Nobel Prize was really given for slightly different reasons,
right,
than what is listed in their media.
Well, it's, yeah. So, Have we actually recorded that already?
No. We have not. No. Yeah, okay. Other than you've mentioned, we'll get to it. So.
Okay, so we'll also, that's all, this is basically all involved in that. So, and all of us became interested in this multi-scale modeling.
All of us meaning?
Marshall and Leavitt and I, different things. I mean, Marshall and I did sort of the first study of that type, so it was a very simple system, relatively small molecule, where these are these pi electron systems where you have a part of the system that's is a conjugated molecule, and then you have side chain methyl groups or something like this, like retinal, which is the visual compound of the eye. And actually, Mary Honig and I did the first multi-scale study of this type, which was a very simple model, and then when Marshall came, we elaborated the model, and then he worked somewhat with Leavitt continuing this. But this was all at a sort of very simplified scale, and it was really only until, that work was done in the 70s, I guess, and it was really only partly in terms of computers and such, that methods like this one described in the paper where Martin Field was really the lead author, which was
the 1990 paper on combined quantum mechanical
potential. Sort of developed the first method, which is a modern method of doing this for complex systems in an accurate way. But I mean, the conceptual idea is the same, that part of the system where a chemical reaction takes place, you have to represent the quantum mechanically. Even that's not entirely true. Sometimes people do quantum mechanical calculations for reactions, fit empirical potentials to the way the reaction occurs, and then just do molecular dynamics. But what was developed here, which in some sense is an outgrowth of, it's kind of curious whether what we give reference to. Not sure. Anyway. And so in terms of a modern, sophisticated way of doing this was really in this paper with Bash and Field. And it was the first paper that represented the methods of doing it that are still used nowadays. So it's not that the concepts are the base of this sort of essential concepts are that different, but that the implementation is much more sophisticated and led to a sophisticated part of CHARM. I mean, it's now, this QMMM methodology is part of CHARM.
Was it part of CHARM before this 1990 work with Martin Field and Bash?
We had a very simple MNDO type model that was used, which actually may still exist somewhere in CHARM, though I don't think it's used anymore. I mean, we are generally, me, just like my office, and we generally don't throw things away to clean up the program. There are things there that sometimes just don't get used at all. But and then we made. So, again, I sort of tried to mention papers that represent the real advance. I mean, there are a lot of papers, that sort of grow out of them. But the first application, which was really a very important one, and was one to an enzyme, was the one to triosphosphate isomerase.
That's the 91 publication in Biochem.
Right, the 91 publication in Biochem, which involved both Bash and Field. Here, Paul Bash was sort of the lead author, if you like. Mm-hmm. But then it was also in collaboration with Greg Petsko's group, who provided some of the crystal structures that we used. And it was really a pioneering calculation, which made a number of predictions that, of which the most important one was that, which violated sort of all of the dogma of the organic chemists, that a histidine normally is a proton donor for certain reactions. But normally the histidine that's a proton donor has two hydrogens at a certain position and it gives one of them up in the reaction. Well, we calculated that, in fact, the histidine that gave up hydrogen didn't actually have two there, but went to amino acid, which instead of having one, the neutral position, actually gave up this proton and became a negative ion. And we showed by the calculations that we weren't able to absolutely show which way the reaction was catalyzed, but we showed that if it were from the protonated histidine, then it would end up in an intermediate which was so stable that the reaction wouldn't take place. Well, if it was from the neutral to the ionized histidine, it would give a reasonable potential surface. And this was a real prediction. And, it's one of these things that also appears in various of my writings, that many of the theoretical chemists use the word predictions when they find something which is in agreement with the experiment. But this was a real prediction, and it wasn't believed. But then Jeremy Knowles' group, actually stimulated by this, did some NMR experiments and indeed showed that this was correct. And since then it's been shown that in a number of other reactions that the histidine, this ion, is actually the active part. So I think it was very important that way. Again, there was doubt about it, but it was published, and then Jeremy Knowles, who was here, professor at Harvard, and was one of the reasons why we worked on triosphosphate isomerase, that, it's often difficult to get experimentalists to sort of work with you because they think it's a waste of time, and so that's we started working on it, and then, of course, Greg was doing the crystal structure, so it was really a very fruitful environment where we knew if we did something, it would really be of use. Mm. Now,
go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, now the computer simulations by QMMM methods, are a big industry in biophysics or whatever, and many people are working on them. Marshall has continued to work on them very actively. It has sort of moved to other areas, but I think this was an important paper. And from my point of view, it was that we really predicted something and that didn't agree with what everybody thought.
Can I ask to push that back in terms of development, back to this conceptual times? Are you and Barry Honiger working on this? You and Ari Warshall eventually work on this, and then he and Levitt kind of go off and continue works for a time.
Right.
Where did the idea to merge the quantum mechanical and the molecular mechanical method come from?
Well, I think...
Again, is this part of that sort of scaling back to the basics of what you can get away with
I mean, to a certain extent, that some of these, even these simpler molecules, which which one couldn't have handled if you really had to do it in the treat everything quantum mechanically. I mean, and they're in these simpler molecules, you could treat the inner shells, you didn't worry about, so they only had one valence electron on each of the atoms. And why did I want to work on retinal? This was because it's the visual pigment, and it was very interested in vision. This goes all the way back to when I was an undergraduate here at Harvard
with Wald
and Ruth Hubbard, and I don't know whether we talked about this, but there was a volume sort of appalling Festschrift.
We did talk about that. That helped inspire your.
That I realized that people hadn't really gotten any further than they were when that was written, and said, well, this is something we can do. And it also sort of goes back, again, we probably have discussed this, that this actually used some of the methodology that Coulson wanted me to use, which I thought... When I was in Oxford, we probably did talk about that when I was just beginning to be interested in NMR. But it was really... that was the reason we worked on the system, that I was interested in the vision, and that we could do it better, but still not perfectly. And actually, Klaus Schulten's thesis was also on that. And again, I don't know how much we discussed this, but there were Brian Kohler was doing experiments on it here.
In the 70s? In the early 70s?
Yeah, he was an assistant professor here, and that was later than that. When was this? Yeah. I mean, when some of these other... And Brian Sykes was also here, was doing NMR experiments. Mm. That was, it was in the 70s, you're right. It was in 1970. This is also one of the first papers where the nuclear Oberhauser effect was used to look at things, but I don't think it had any effect on the rest of the world from that point of view. But
the time from when you have these early conceptions of how to do these sort of multi-scale, the QM and MM methods, up until these publications in the 90s when you're working with Martin Field and Bash and Greg Petsko, why do you think there's such a gap there between...
You couldn't do meaningful calculations.
In terms of the computer accessibility?
In terms of the basically the computing power and the early... I mean, Leavitt and Warshall did a study of lysozyme, and it was completely wrong. But it was one of their early studies, which are listed in the Nobel Prize thing. It's just, they just couldn't do it. And
because they didn't have the big enough computer to calculate?
Or they actually had bigger computers. Israel had this Golem, this homemade computer, which was pretty good. But still, they couldn't do it. And I think in the biological area, as I may have said before, one of the very important aspects about being successful is that you don't do a problem if you can't do it. And again, many people come to me and say, look, is this interesting, molecular dynamics, you can do everything. But I tell them, well, you can do everything, but we can't do your problem. And so the realization of what problems are accessible by the methods you have, I think has been one of the essential things why I haven't wasted more time than I have on sort of dead ends and such.
In the 1980s, in the mid-1980s, the NSF made a massive investment in supercomputers in domestic United States. Mm. And before that, there was a real challenge in getting access to computers, and you had to go
in the mid-70s to France to run your BPTI calculations.
Right, and a lot of the calculations we did here, there were quite a few VAXs around.
Here at Harvard?
Not at the medical school, different places. And they were only used during the day when people were running, almost nothing. And so we went around all over the place and got permission to use the VAX at night, and then we would give them credit. And that's a lot of our calculations were done this way.
On just available computers?
Just available
other
computer
institutions.
Time that existed and weren't being used. And the VAXs were fairly widely distributed, and so that the programs that we developed here could be used just without any problem on these other computers.
So the CHARM program was developed in part with VAXs in mind.
Yeah.
I guess my question was going to be, did that push for supercomputing in the 80s influence your work? Because I know that there wasn't necessarily a nearby supercomputing center here, but some of those centers were eventually kind of connected through the ARPANET.
Right, yeah.
Did that supercomputing push in the 80s influence your work on molecular dynamics?
We certainly began, that's the Pittsburgh Supercomputer Center, and I don't know when we first started using it.
Oh, but that's who you collaborated with once it was established there.
Right, yeah. So we were able to use that, and of course, Popel was in Pittsburgh doing the QM calculations and such, and so that was the first one that we used.
And would you share your material over this early ARPANET?
We would send tapes, and they would run them and then get them back.
Oh, through the mail?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Mainly, yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. This pulls us a little bit off track, but I am interested in some of these advances in computing, but especially with the rise of the internet, mm-hmm. the increased use of personal computers, their easily accessibility, how that has changed the way you do your work, how your science has evolved.
Well, I mean, how?
If at all.
No, sorry. Well, we've had computers. I mean, we used to have 8 or 10 computers, and we had Silicon Graphics and other computers that we used here a lot. A significant fraction of our computing was done here, and then we had, a small cluster of computers here.
Was this in the 90s?
This was in the 90s, yeah. And then Harvard started to have a computer center, and its advantage was that, again, it was a little bit that we would buy a certain number of computers with them. I mean,
you would co-purchase your group and then Harvard as well.
And we would say they had 100, and then we would add 10 of them or something, and we would get first priority on those 10, but be able to use sponge computing on when other things weren't in use, and correspondingly when we didn't use ours, which was very rare, they could use that. So that was used. So that was this growth, and the other was.
And just to clarify, those were essentially cluster computers.
Right. Yeah. Now then, there was a CDC at in Berkeley. There was. Was outside the secret at the Livermore, I guess, that we got access to, and it was similar to the one that had been in. The dates I'm really very poor, but we knew some people there and were able to get access there. And I guess there we used the. I don't remember whether it was still the ARPANET or whatever. And
to share your data with them.
To share the data and. Most recently, we've been using NERSC, Northwest Energy Source Computing Center, which is a very big computing center, and they always have state-of-the-art computers, and they give us lots of computer time. Well, they like to have the computers fully used, then they can ask for bigger ones. And we and some of the other people involved doing molecular dynamics simulations are one of the largest users there. And so
of this Northwest group?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And is that a private?
No, it's an energy resource.
Oh. It's a part of the DOE funding?
Yeah, that's right. And they are out there because, you know, water power is very cheap, and cooling is maybe the most, and electricity is very cheap, and that's why Intel is out there. And that's I don't know the exact reason, but that's certainly why they have.
Yeah, water was a big reason why they went to Portland.
Yeah.
They have a big factory there.
So the electricity and the cooling together, and so there is this big resource, which is, other than maybe at Livermore, with the defense-related computers, it's probably the biggest reason. And we use that. We do some computing here, still at Harvard, which actually isn't at Harvard now, but is somewhere downtown, where again, it's cheaper to control the temperature and such. And so we do almost all of it there.
Was getting access to those computers or the clusters over time, was that difficult initially?
Well, you had to write write proposals, and I think at a certain stage, getting large amounts of time was difficult, and you had to write. There were these insight proposals where you got money for time for a year or two, and. But nowadays, as I say, well, one, our computer demands are less because my group is much smaller, and there's no problem in getting what we need.
Something that's in terms of proposals that has changed over the course of your career as well is NSF proposals increasingly, or over time, started requiring social impact aspects. Are you familiar with those changes?
Yeah.
How has that changed how you have written proposals or how you think about the purpose of your work? Has it?
I don't think it hasn't changed at all about the purpose of my work. And of course, this is relatively recent that it's been sort of both NIH and NSF outreach and such. But now with the Nobel Prize, I mean, I give so many lectures to young people and such. But it's really no, and that's actually one of the ways that I've used the Nobel Prize is to accept invitations where I speak to young people. I mean, the first invitation that I accepted was to go to Houston, Texas, where there was the annual meeting of it's a special honor society. Did we talk about that? No. For students at traditionally black colleges like FISK. And apparently, though the exact details of that I'm still tracking down, at a certain stage, black students weren't allowed, at least at some of the meetings of the American Chemical Society. I think it wasn't the policy. May just have been, and the meeting was in the South or something like that. So I really wanted to find out about it. But that's so they started this parallel honor society and annual meeting where the students could go and give talks and listen to lectures and such. And they invited me, I think it was in 2014. But at the end of this program, they had some very good speakers, all of whom were black, and try to invite somebody who gives the summa lecture at the end. And the woman called me up, and it was clear to me that she didn't expect me to say yes. And so I looked into it more, and then I said, "Yeah, I'd love to do it." And so I did it, and it was really. Fabulous, I mean, experience for me. I gave again my marsupial lecture, more or less, and Well, the students were just so excited, and of course, everybody wanted to have their picture taken with the iPhone with me and such. And that was a wonderful experience for me, and from what I heard afterwards, I think it was really a great experience for them. Mm-hmm. And so I've tried to do things like that. There's also the Harlem Society for Disadvantaged Children or something like that, which in New York, again, tries to take students from the poorer neighborhoods. And they both, they arrange for them to work in laboratories for 6 months or something like that. And then, again, they have a sort of graduation-type ceremony, and they invite somebody, and they invited me, and I give a lecture there. So, you know, it's in terms of outreach, it's something that has naturally happened and has been sort of, for me, the thing I wanted to use my Nobel Prize for. Mm. I mean, that it really is, you know, it's something that it's sort of one of the, it's probably the only sort of science-related prize that everybody recognizes, whether or not they know anything about science. And so I think you can do a lot of good with it, and that's what I sort of have tried to do.
Have there been any challenges that have arisen as a result of the Nobel Prize? I mean, these are some beautiful opportunities, and you've really, sounds like you've leveraged them in some really lovely ways. But have there also been some challenges that have arisen because of it?
You have to learn to say no, but I don't, you know, it's as, well, when there was the, after I received the Nobel Prize, then there was sort of a celebration right that morning that was organized, and there were two others, E.J. Corey and Dudley Hirschbach, both won the Nobel Prize. And E.J. Said, come and see me after, you know, when you have a chance. And he told me, you won the Nobel Prize, and you can do what you want. And what he basically had is, and this was true also in the whole Nobel Prize celebration, where they urge you to go to all these places, and I decided, well, I would go. I have a former student who is at Umeå, which is, you know, not in all the universities around Stockholm and such, where nobody goes. And so I said, well, I'd rather go up there than do that. But he said, sort of in trivial things, and also, you know, as far as he was concerned, after he came back, he was willing to devote 2 weeks for things related to the Nobel Prize, and then he was just going to, had just gone back to work. And he also said that I was very lucky that I got it when I was so much older, because I had so much more time to work without being faced with these decisions. But, you know, I think what he said, you know, was, I think, really very important in, you know, making me realize, you know, I have the prize, and I use it where I think it can do something good. Lots of invitations. I mean, I keep getting invitations that I say no to, and like there's one sort of question. There was some climate change conferences where they, I guess, always try to invite Nobel Prize winners. And I thought a little bit about that. I don't really know anything about climate change, but I finally decided, look, I have several experts on atmospheric physics here at Harvard, Steve Wofsy. And so I said, look, if you want somebody who can talk about that, you invite them. I actually haven't asked them whether they were invited or not, but I've just decided, you know, if it's a topic that I don't know anything about, other than the one that I did finally accept was the OPCW one.
The Chemical Weapons Convention.
Yeah. And thanks to you and Caruso, I had something to say. Yeah. But in general, I mean, I don't, you know, Marcy and I get these email invitations, and I think they're becoming more and more obvious that I should say no. I mean, I keep getting them from India, from these schools, and
go ahead.
I was just going to say, so the short answer is no, I don't think really. I mean, certainly I think about it, I have a much broader field of opportunity to do things, but making the decisions is not that difficult.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. Can you take us back to when you heard, we are told that you were awarded the prize. Mm-hmm. Where were you? What was the context? How did you hear?
Well, I was in bed. Well, you know, because I was in the U.S. rather than in France. And I probably it's worth saying that for quite a few, I knew that I was being nominated for the prize for at least 20 years, maybe more than that. And for a while, particularly when we were in Europe, I knew it was announced. I would say ahead of time, 11:30 or something, and I would sit by my computer. Of course, I would have been notified before then, but anyway, and see whether this was my year. And then I'd sort of given up, decided, well, okay, I'm not going to get it. And then we were here in the U.S., so it was 5:30 in the morning, and we were in bed, and Marcy was closer to the phone, so she picks up the phone, and this was 5:30 in the morning, 11:30 there. And my first reaction was that I have a daughter in Israel, and she often has called to say to reassure us that, you know, when there's been a terrorist attack or something or other, at odd hours like that, since time, they're 7 hours ahead. That was what I thought, but she said, no, somebody wants to talk to you, they have a foreign accent or something like that. And so, okay, so I could then go and they...
Did you have an inclination as to, since it wasn't your daughter, what it might be?
No, I didn't really, it was too, you know, I wasn't awake, really.
Yeah.
Then sort of the whole committee sort of gets on one after the other, and finally the secretary of the committee, who was a biophysicist and had known for a number of years, when she said it, you know, then I really believed that it was. And very shortly after, we were hardly up, somebody rings at our doorbell, and Misha happened to be there, though he's been in New York for most of the time. And he goes to the door, and so he calls somebody at the door. And so my wife goes and looks, and it's the young woman, Stephanie, who's a local reporter for the Harvard Gazette, who happens to live right around the corner from us. And she said, well, she was from the Gazette, and could she take some pictures? And
you were just getting up.
It was hardly. So she said, you just wait here. Said, well, you know, got me to get dressed. And then I got dressed. And then we allowed her to come in. And she started talking to me and taking pictures. And this was before. And so I said, look, we're going to just go ahead and have breakfast. And I guess, although I almost always make breakfast, Marcy made it, she reminded me just recently when I was writing this up, that she actually had made breakfast, and so all of this was recorded, you know, what the Nobel Prize winner has for breakfast. and she took, there's one very nice picture of me sitting in the armchair where I often sat in bed. And then there was this Harvard, so they called up and said, are you available at 11 or whatever? And so there was a celebration. And a number of people said, you know, very nice things. I guess one that I George Whiteside really made sort of a nice review. He's very good at that. But one that I appreciated very much was from Stuart Schreiber, who said that, you know, he had been invited, I think it was, he must have been, he was at Yale, to become a Harvard professor to carry on synthetic organic chemistry. He'd worked with Woodward and then on to Yale and was supposed to do that. And that he had felt that when he started going into biological work, applying, you know, like, you know, this FKBP and other things, that the rest of the organic faculty really didn't like this, but that, you know, I had encouraged him, and we talked about this, that he very much appreciated that. That was one. The other thing was that Alan Garber, who's the provost, came. He had no idea who I was. He had some flowers, and he was looking around what to do with them. So I said, well, this is my wife over there, and then, you know. And then I said, but he asked, is there anything I can do for you, I think. People often ask that, and that's sort of a mistake. So I said, well.
Why is it a mistake?
Well, because I always have something in mind. And, well, what actually had happened is that, you know, there's a shortage of space. And I had, I guess, Jacobson was the chairman at the time, and we discussed, you know, that I wanted to keep certain parts of it. I didn't, other parts I didn't need anymore, and I was happy to give up. But the statement was, you know, that no space belongs to anybody, and it's departmental space or the university space or something. Though he said he had talked to the dean and asked about that, and was told, well, he couldn't promise me that I could keep the space. So when Garber was there, I, you know, said, there's one thing you can do for me, and that's to guarantee me that as long as I'm working here, I can keep the space that I have here. And he said yes, and I said, well, I think it's important to have it in writing, and because I know that even if I do get it in writing, sometimes the dean's administration says that they didn't mean what they said, which actually has happened to me. So anyway, I did get this, and I think there is no problem about my keeping the space. So, but it does sort of come up that they tried. I have an extra room that I really don't need, but it's still nice to have. And there's talk about somebody using it, and then so nothing ever happens. But anyway, so that was the. So it was the EJ's comments, Stuart Schreiber, and my interaction with Garber, which were the sort of initial events before we went to Stockholm. And then, of course, we went down and had a visit with President Obama.
Before we talk about your visit with Obama, did you go to Stockholm to accept the award?
Yes.
Next? Was that the next step?
Well, the visit with Obama was before we left there, yeah.
So, yeah, go ahead and then please tell us about that.
Well, I mean, that was, well, we got invited. And I knew the science advisor, his name is Holgren, he's still the science advisor. And I said, look, if this was just going to be a photo op, I wasn't really interested in going after having received the invitation, and which was in November. And then he said, well, if you receive the invitation of the president, either you can only refuse in two things, if you're dead or if you're dying or if a relative has died. And so I said, okay, but this, what do you think? I mean, is there, can it be anything more? And he said, well, you know, he's the president. If he's interested in what you're about, then it can be longer, and it's, you know, it's up to him what to do. And I won't go through all the details of, but just mention what did happen. Actually, once we were in in the Oval Office that you sort of always you form some sort of a line, and normally physics would be first, then chemistry, then physiology and medicine, and then economics.
Is that so how they always do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole Nobel. And then within each prize, if there's more than one person, it's alphabetical. That's and that's how you give your lecture. Everything is sort of done this way. And since there was no, since the physics prize was given to Europeans, the chemistry prize was first, and since my name is first, I was first in the Oval Office, so actually Marcy was first. And then so we form a line, and then we go up to see the president.
In the office, in the
Oval Office. In the Oval Office, yeah. And it's very impressive, and he's, well, when Marcy came in first, he said, "Hello, Marcy, it's really nice to see you." And, you know, even though he had been in a very important meeting, he just has switched, and that was what he was focusing on. And so when I went up to him, I said to him, "You're the second president I've ever met. The first president was President Truman in 1947, and he was the first president to try to institute universal health insurance. And Obama thought for a second, said, no, that's not true, it was Theodore Roosevelt. And then he thought again, and he sort of stands up and looks. He said, no, you're right, it was Roosevelt did propose it, but he wasn't elected. It was just a campaign promise. For a second, you know, he had these two, for a second, where he wasn't elected in between. And so, you know, and so then I said, well, but you're the first president to have actually done it. And then I gave him a copy of my photo book, yeah. Which I...
What did he say to that when you told him you were the person who had done it?
Well, he sort of smiled. And he didn't really say anything, he just smiled, and then I gave him a copy of the photo book, which I dedicated to him and Michelle, and he looked at it a little bit and then gave it to some assistant. And just as an aside, in France, contrary to my going to see the president came to see me.
In France?
Yeah, he came to Strasbourg. Now it was not only just to see me, but he also then used the occasion to make a talk about science and the importance of science in France and such. But I also have lovely pictures with him, and I gave him a copy of the photo book. And I said, you're going to see President Obama in 2 weeks. Ask him what he's looked at. I never. Holland is a very charming individual, personally. I think no president can really do anything much about the economy. And you know, he's obviously not been very successful, but I don't know what will happen. But anyway, so that's...
So after visiting President Obama, and then you traveled to Europe, did you go directly to to Stockholm for the ceremony, or did you travel through, did you spend some time in France?
No, at that time we just went directly. And, you know, and many families, you're allowed to bring about 10 people or something like that. And so Marcy, Misha, Reba, and Tammy, Rachel, my granddaughter, and then the oldest daughter, my oldest niece was there, and then various friends were there.
What was the experience like for you?
Mixed.
In what ways?
Well, I mean, I worked very hard on my lecture, and it's, you know, I mean, there's this dinner of 1,300 people in the grand hall and everything, and it's Well, it's a little bit too organized. I mean, some things are nice. The nicest thing is that you have a chauffeur who's essentially there any time of day or night for you. You have a car and a chauffeur, and then you have somebody from the Foreign Office who is sort of mixed to make sure that you do what you're supposed to do, and also to help you to do it. They were very good. And sort of learned how to work together there. And sometimes when there was an occasion that I just didn't want to. Neither Marcy or I wanted to participate in some of the big dinners. We just said, look, we'd like to go to a nice restaurant, and the chauffeur actually had good contacts with us and suggested a nice restaurant. I said, well, if it's so nice, will there be any room? Well, you don't worry, we'll, and things like that. So again, we tried to sort of do things the way we wanted them to, and it worked out well.
When you had these ideas about your winning Nobel and being awarded for something that you think might have been for different reasons, how did that shape you there at the lecture that you gave there?
Well, I mean, this is, I don't know how much you've read my Nobel. I mean, there's the Nobel lecture, and then there's a article that you write for Angewandte Chemie. And, well, what I did in the lecture is, well, it was awarded, officially for what we've already discussed, but I just talked about the origin of molecular dynamics and how early work, looking at the H plus H2 direct reaction in the 60s, realizing that classical mechanics could describe these light atoms, so it should certainly work for proteins, and how that sort of developed molecular dynamics. And that's what I mentioned the RA and that work we had done and such, but basically it was about molecular dynamics and its applications, rather than about what it had been given. I mean, that the lecture is supposed to be how you've done work that in terms of what you're awarded the Nobel Prize for led to it, but I didn't do that. And then afterwards I discovered I'd actually been given a book called The Politics of Science, which talks about the Nobel Prize, and specifically it points out that 50 years after the Nobel Prize has been given, the books are open, and the whole discussion of what the people who gave you the prize went through is all documented and made available. And so I talked a lot about Einstein and how much opposition there was to giving him the Nobel Prize, and specifically for giving him the Nobel Prize for general relativity, which had already been certain elements had been proved, and obviously was his most important work, and so they gave it to him finally for the photoelectric effect, and he was furious about that. And he first of all didn't, I guess he was in Japan when he heard about it, and then he didn't go to Stockholm. He gave his lecture in Göteborg, and basically he talked about general relativity rather than about the photoelectric effect. And so in my version of the Nobel lecture, which is mainly the Nobel lecture, but toward the end it talks about Einstein, and it talks about what I think is true, that although the Nobel Prize was officially given for that, if there hadn't been any molecular dynamics, there wouldn't have been a Nobel Prize. I mean, that was the really important thing, but somehow they wanted to have some sort of topic where they could give it to three people, because they like to give it to three people. There's so many that nowadays, and to delimit the subject, and that's why it was given to this. And I talked a number of times with the head of the committee. I mean, there are five people that also call, who really make most of the decision, even though finally it's officially voted by the Swedish Academy. And, you know, he kept telling me, well, you have to remember the Nobel Prize wasn't given for molecular dynamics. I said, well, so we had this discussion back and forth, but anyway, so that's my feeling about that. As I say, that there wouldn't have been a prize if they hadn't. I mean, nobody would have cared about these multi-scale modeling if you couldn't really apply it, and for that you needed to do molecular dynamics. Hmm. So that's the story on that.
Yeah. There are a few other collections of work that we haven't covered, maybe just reference to. How are you feeling right now as far as where you're at?
Beginning to get tired, not surprisingly, and maybe we can skip them.
Sure.
I don't know.
I'll just make brief mention if there's something that comes up for you.
Okay.
One of them had to do with the acidity constant, or the acid ionization constant, of groups and proteins,
mm-hmm.
and the details in a continuum of electrostatic model.
Yeah, I mean, they're all papers where I think what we did, again, with my students or postdocs, this was Don Bashford, who actually had been a student with David Weaver, where sort of a simplified model had, in this case, had existed before, which was sort of an average model for calculating the pKa's, and we realized that this sort of similar like Hartree-Fock theory in quantum mechanics, that under certain conditions, if each group is more or less independent, it would work, but it doesn't work if the groups are strongly interacting. And Don Bashford basically developed for the first time, that was carried on by Michael Schaefer afterward, a model where you really considered all the groups. And the problem with that is that, you know, if you have 10 titratable group in a protein, each one can have a proton and not have any proton, then of course you very quickly get a very large number of possibilities. And so people had avoided this. And Don Bashford set up the calculation so you included all of them, but you realized that most of them didn't titrate in a given range, so you only had to include a few at a time, which made the calculation possible. And now lots have been written. I mean, this is one of these pioneering papers that was also at the right time, because then other people, Barry Honig in particular, has done a lot of work on titration and such. No.
There's another collection of articles that you were interested in talking about, where essentially around energy surfaces and protein folding, which I think we touched upon there.
Yeah, it may be. Yeah, I mean, there are other things, but we can skip that.
Mm. And then lastly, something that I actually am interested in hearing you talk a little bit about is some of the work with crystallographic refinement,
mm-hmm.
with molecular dynamics, work that you might have done with Axel Brunger or John Currien.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how that worked? That seemed to be something that happened really in the mid-80s.
Right. Yeah. And
Axel Brunger was initially Klaus Schulten's student in Germany and then came over to work with you
right,
as a postdoc.
That's right. And spent a number of years here.
Mm-hmm. And that was also kind of picking up on some of your nuclear magnetic resonance work.
Right, right.
But then
right.
pulling in the simulations. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that, how that evolved?
Yeah, well, I guess the original studies that John Currien was a student of Greg Petsko, officially, but he spent all his time here. I mean, it sort of happened, as Greg describes it, that John said, well, I really want to do theoretical work, when he went to work for Petsko, who was at MIT at the time. So Greg said, I know just the person. So he said, he brought him over here. And basically, John spent all of his time here. And at a certain stage in his career, Greg said, look, if you're going to have been my student, you have to do a crystal structure. So he finally refined the crystal structure of myoglobin. But what he actually worked on was to try to test the, use molecular dynamics to test whether the average structure determined by X-ray diffraction was actually the correct average. And so basically he did molecular dynamics simulations on some molecule, probably myoglobin, and then built the let me look just to make sure. Ron Levy was a very good postdoc, but I guess come from medical school. But it doesn't really matter. But the essential idea was that we would represent a crystal essentially, and the motions of the protein in the crystal by doing molecular dynamics calculations, and then we would put the average structure into the standard crystallographic program and refine that structure and see whether we got out the average structure that we put in. I mean, normally people just do the refinement. I mean, they don't add. So we used the molecular dynamics to, it may not have been the correct model of the motions, but we knew exactly what they were, and we were able to test the, you know, whether the standard crystallographic programs were correct. In particular, I mean, there's also people try to estimate the anisotropy of the motion, whether the temperature factors, which is sort of some assumption of how the atoms are moving around, are actually spherical or whether they are cylindrical. And we could test all of these assumptions of X-ray programs, and we found that under many conditions the results were quite good approximations. And on the, if there were too large motions, then they broke down. And I don't think this had a huge effect on crystallographers. Actually, Tom Blundell, who gave the Weaver lecture about 10 years later, he is a crystallographer, picked up this idea and started discussing the same thing. Hmm. But I don't think he referred to us at all. So whether.
What about the. But go ahead, please.
Yeah. And then, sort of, the next thing was, and that's what Axel is really mainly responsible for, though, with John as well. And that was, you know, we had been doing NMR refinements. And the idea was whether one could do refinements using molecular dynamics. Basically, in the NMR refinement, you use molecular dynamics to cover the space, and then use the NMR data as constraints on the motion.
Because you know it's going to make that form, or at least it will touch that form.
Well, we don't know exactly it is actually to determine the structure of it. I mean, you start out with it just an unstructured protein in NMR, and then we put in all the NOEB, distance constraints, approximate ones between different hydrogen atoms, or whatever atoms you have, NMR data, which is mainly hydrogen atoms. And if you have lots of distance constraints, and you and you put these constraints on slowly, then finally the structure will, if there are enough constraints, will actually go to the true structure, because it's overdetermined. You know, that if you have n squared distances and you only have n atoms, you have a lot of data. So that's the idea. And it, now, people used it for a while, a lot, and now there are other programs that people use which have similar ideas but are different.
And that was what emerged, what Axel was working on, has emerged into the Explore program?
And then this same idea, except there, it wasn't actually for structure determinations, but rather for structure refinement, where you had some idea of this. But again, it's the same idea, that essentially you do molecular dynamics and you use the X-ray data as an additional, basically you just, I mean, what we did in the NMR was just take the normal potential function, the charm potential function, and then add to it the distance constraints and do dynamics for the whole thing. And in the X-ray refinement, again, you use the molecular dynamics and the data from the X-ray analysis to constrain. And again, you sort of slowly turn it on to do this. And we published this first paper, and then it appeared clear that, this was something that required a lot of work to make it really useful, and also that it was sort of the whole field by itself, and Axel was very interested in doing that. And so I said, well, you go ahead. And when he went to Yale, he took it with him. I mean, I did invent the name Explore.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. But
where'd that come from? Why?
X-ray exploration, I mean, sort of. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And he's obviously lots of, well, I don't know whether it's still the most used program. It was for a while, and then again, you know, other people who are more interested in sort of the technology of it have done more work on it. And for a long time, he didn't do any crystallography. Now, actually, he spends most of his time doing crystallography and has done some very interesting work on snare proteins and other systems. Mm-hmm. And I think, he's very happy doing that. I mean, that he's really moved in that. And I think he's spending less time on the program. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you both had collaborated on what became Explore, why not try to commercialize it the same way that CHARM had been done?
Well, it was.
Oh, I thought Explore was open access.
Huh. Well, that's a big story itself.
Do you mind telling it?
Well, it's just that Explore was commercialized as a separate program by Accelerus. And then Axel, who I guess had got so annoyed with them, quite reasonably, you know, similarly, I guess I've been annoyed with them also, that they didn't do anything for the program. They just sold it, basically.
They didn't do any development for it.
They didn't do any development. Just if they didn't do any development for CHARM, as I told you, that the initial idea of doing the whole thing was that they would. And so I guess he actually, said he was going to, well, he wrote another program whose name I've forgotten. I don't know. Which, if you look at it, is Explore, basically. It's something to all, something like CNS.
Oh, yeah, CNS, that's right.
Yeah. Which I always think of has something to do with the central nervous system, which is more interested in nowadays, but anyway. And so he wrote this, but, you know, anybody who looked at it would know that, yes, it was Explore, maybe a little bit different. And so there was a big battle and an arbitration proceeding.
Because he's saying, yes, he did.
He wants his independent, right, yeah.
And let it be free.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether free or...
Licensed,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, but sort of like charm, maybe actually free. You know, the world has progressed a little bit in that sense, that there are so many open... And anyway, and there was arbitration, and finally, I don't know exactly whether there were any monetary terms. And it, of course, it was negotiations between Yale and whatever the company was, probably Accelerus by that time. And Accelerus, I guess, kept Explore, and Axel was allowed to distribute CNS. I believe that's the situation nowadays. And other people, Clore at NIH, I think, has done a lot with continuing Explore, but I don't really know since it's not something I'm involved in. But that's sort of the story. And it was a little bit, and you know, I mean, there's been a question, well, since all the different companies have never lived up to their obligations as far as charm is concerned, should one try to do something? And I've had there's this group of core developers for charm, which are five people: Charlie and Bernie Brooks, and Leonard Nielsen, and Benoit Roux, and now Michael Feig. We're sort of trying to get the next generation people involved also, but it's a very small group that sort of decide about the future of charm and then get together, though it still turns out that I really make the decision if there's any argument. But and well, some of them have said, well, look, let's get rid of Accelerus or whatever, they don't do anything for us. And and my feeling is, well, having seen what Axel went through, I certainly don't want to go through something like that, and I don't think it's worth it. And just, now this is off the record, I'm actually having a meeting on Friday where I hope, where we will be talking, where there was this big meeting of the SALT on Monday, for two of the Simulia and BioVia, which are two simulation brands that they have, as they talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably my fun.
Yeah.
Where were we? We must be close.
Yeah, we were wrapping up some of your discussion about the commercializations
I was just saying off the record that I'm supposed to meet on Friday with a number of the important people in BioVia, which is the latest incarnation of Accelerus, and to find out what they will do for us in terms of supporting the program more and all the things that haven't happened.
Yeah.
So I hope.
There's an opportunity there.
Yeah.
Well, the last things I'm interested in if you have the energy to talk about, is some of the family aspects that... Misha came around in the early 80s, and if there was some sort of change in your work as a result of a new young child, or how did that challenge some of the work that was being done?
Well, not at all. He was a very easy child, and when Marcy has always been my secretary or administrator, and when he had to when he was home, I would often I always liked to work at home in the morning and then come in the afternoon. This was always, which I sort of discovered by accident when we were living in Brookline, that traffic was bad in the morning, so I'd come in the afternoon. And then I suddenly realized doing all this work at home in the morning when nobody bothered me was really a great system. So even when we moved back to Cambridge, I kept the system and would work at home in the morning. And so I would take care of Misha, and then, he would just sit in the crib or whatever, and he was a very easy child. I say hello to him ever so often or give him something. So it really had really no effect on my life, maybe too little effect, according to Marcy or something. I mean, she says I work all the time, and I guess in a sense it's true that I sort of, when I'm working, I work. And we have to go off somewhere, like we're going off to Newport for her birthday for a couple of days, and then I'm happy to do these other things. Yeah.
Mm. Are there any other things that you wanted to talk about?
Not really. I guess in some of the things that you had listed, I mean, there was one thing about science support or something like that, its effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
And well, again, this has come up in terms of my coming to Columbia. We talked about that, right? And the Watson Lab, and
mm-hmm.
yeah. And this also happened later on, where at a certain stage, the Atomic Energy Commission, I was getting support mainly from NSF in those days, and I think, yeah, not from NIH. Was mainly working in chemical reactions.
While at Columbia?
This was... yeah, mainly while I was at Columbia.
So in the 50s?
Yeah.
Mm.
And then... 60s.
Oh.
Yeah. And 60-65.
Okay.
And the atomic... I was working chemical reactions and getting support from NSF. The Atomic Energy Commission asked me if I wanted them to... they said they would like to support me. And you know, that I wouldn't have to write long grants or anything, but they were just giving me money. So I said, okay.
They came to you?
They came to me because they were interested in calculations about chemical reactions that I was doing. What it had to do with anything, I never realized. But anyway, so... but then after a few years, they decided, well, they weren't interested in anymore. And so then we had to negotiate to get back with my NSF grant and everything. And so, you know, I think this theme that one really wants to be sure that you're working for an organization that is interested in what you're doing, that's important for them, is something for people to keep in mind. And as I probably said earlier, it also has to do with working in industry, that you may find out that, yeah, they hire you when you come out, they treat you royally, and then, you know, their interest shifts, so either you do something entirely different, or you don't do anything, and you can't advance unless you become a manager, I think, which you don't have to do in a university. That's another great thing. And, so anyway, I'm a very strong believer and urge my students, you know, that they really should... they're interested in science, even though the beginning may seem easier, you know, in the first few years when they get support and everything and they're treated royally. It's much better to work in a university where science is what they want, mm-hmm. you know, to do for you to do well as teaching also. Mm-hmm. So maybe the last thing I will say against universities and Harvard is that you only get paid for teaching classrooms. And when with my travels back and forth, I finally went to half-time and then stopped, and then emeritus, basically then Harvard doesn't pay you anything, even though all the time, you spend most of your time teaching graduate students and postdoctoral fellows. It certainly counts whether they're going to promote you, you know, whether you're doing good science, but they don't pay you for anything for that. And I think that's really, well, I've objected to that, but of course it makes no difference, but I think it's really sort of can't quite think of the word for it, but it's...
unpaid labor.
That's one, but sort of it's inconsistent is sort of a mild version of that.
Mm.
And I really think that that's of course, the university, you know, gets tuition and everything because you're teaching classes, and so. But I still think it's inconsistent at worst that they don't do that. So maybe leave it at that.
That sounds
but
good.
Even though I'm great supporter of university research, nothing is perfect.
Mm.
Okay.
That's very good. Thank you again so much for your time.
Well, it's been a pleasure and recalls a lot of things.
Yes.
And I look forward in the course of time.
See how it emerges.
Yeah.
Thank you.